This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
It was a dark and cold evening on December 22nd, 2000. Business as usual for the National Museum in Stockholm, Sweden. But just 5 minutes before closure came a shocking turn of events. At 4:55 p.m., a man armed with a submachine gun entered the building, demanding all the museum goers lay down on the ground. Two other men amongst the other museum goers suddenly pulled out handguns, making the same threats. Within a matter of minutes, the thieves stole three paintings, two Renoirs, and a self-portrait by Rembrandt. The trio of criminals left the museum, carrying $42 million worth of stolen art. The minutes felt like hours for the terrified people in the museum as they waited for police, but it would take authorities 40 minutes to arrive. The thieves had detonated two car bombs in the city, diverting attention away from the museum. With the roads blocked, the three criminals boarded a speedboat and made their escape. It would have been the perfect heist, if not for the work of FBI Special Agent Robert Whitman. I'm Emily Campagno, and this is the Fox True Crime Podcast. For an art heist of this magnitude, Swedish authorities knew who they had to turn to. FBI Special Agent Robert Whitman played a pivotal role in the way the Bureau handles art crimes. Throughout his 20-year career with the FBI, Special Agent Whitman assisted with the recovery of over $300 million worth of stolen art and cultural properties. His investigations have secured the successful convictions of numerous criminals. In 2005, he founded the FBI's very own art crime team and was named the division's senior investigator. In his memoir, Priceless, Robert details stories from his illustrious career, sharing just how he returned the world's stolen treasures. Today, retired FBI Special Agent Robert Whitman joins me with an inside look at this thrilling heist and the safe return of these important paintings. Bob, tell us a little bit about the realm of art crime. How common is art theft, fakes, forgery, etc. across the world?
Yeah, the problem with art theft and trying to identify what it is that the United States doesn't really keep figures when it comes to crime involving theft. Specifically for art. And so what I can tell you is this, the entire art industry in the world is a $200 billion industry annually. So every year, $200 billion worth of art, cultural property, antiquities, artifacts get bought and sold. And it's not just what we talk about, you know, when we talk about sculptures, fine arts, and prints, we're also talking about collectibles. So that $200 billion industry represents all types of collectibles, including things like sports cards, sports cars, for that matter, cars, yeah, magazines, comic books, all of that is part of the $200 billion industry. Now, back in the early 2000s, I got a call from our headquarters at the FBI in Washington, and they had gotten a request, I believe it was from the New York Times, to find out what was the value of the criminal art market every year. So I did a research working with the Carabinieri in Italy, the OCBC, which is the National Art Crime Team in France, and the Art and Antique Squad in London. And we came up with a figure of about $6 billion a year, which represents the actual true crime number for the illicit cultural property crime in the world. I think today, because of the rise in value of art and cultural property, I think it's a little bit more. And, you know, recently things have gone really skyrocketed. A painting recently sold supposedly by Da Vinci sold for $400 million. That's the most expensive painting ever sold. And a baseball card, okay, believe it or not, a Mickey Mantle rookie card from the early 1950s recently sold for $12 million. So when we start seeing figures like this, it gives rise to crime, because the criminals out there are seeing the same things we are, and they're finding ways of monetizing, stealing, and making this happen.
Makes you want to check your basement for those old baseball cards and see if you can come up 12 million. So, all right, so we have a couple facts and figures under our belt. Now, how well equipped would you say are museums when it comes to protecting art and artifacts? Aside from the collectibles and the sports memorabilia for a second, just focusing on museums, do you feel they're adequately protected?
Well, you have to remember, Emily, that the museums, there are sports cards memorabilia museums. There's golfing memorabilia museums. Recently, there was a spate of thefts from the Yogi Berra museum, also from the racing museum in Saratoga. And so these all come together. Generally speaking, in the U.S., we have pretty good security at museums. I do a lot of security surveys. I go into museums and help them develop their systems, their electronics, their processes. And from what I've seen, it's pretty good. Now, compared to Europe, it's much better. Europe's not very good at all. The problem with Europe is that, some of the buildings and museums are hundreds and hundreds of years old. The walls are very, very thick. Electronics, internet, that type of thing doesn't penetrate. So as a result, their electronic systems aren't as good as ours. In the U.S., we're doing pretty well. We don't have a whole lot of museum heists. Of course, the biggest art heist in the world was in Boston in 1990 at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. So we're holding the record at $500 million for the single largest art heist in the world.
Leave it to the Americans to go big or go home. I mean, a lot of this has been sort of romanticized in the entertainment industry. We picture Ocean's 11. We picture The Italian Job and the remake of that film, where, to your point, a lot of the heists that allegedly or apparently occur in Europe involve sort of a choreography that takes great delicacy because of the historic nature of these buildings and the surrounding areas and the neighborhoods and whatnot. Let's talk about the training in terms of becoming an expert on art authentication, which is a very specific and very valuable in and of itself role. Tell us about what that is like.
Well, there's a difference between art authentication, art history, art forensics, and art theft and art investigation. So when we're looking at this from a criminal standpoint, the investigators that are involved, the police, are not authenticators. They're not art experts in a specific type of art. They have some training at the art crime team and at the FBI. They've received some training as to how to identify, let's just say, for example, the difference between a Picasso and maybe a Renoir. Now, that doesn't sound to art aficionados, that sounds pretty simplistic. But the truth is, when it comes to policemen, they have no idea what the difference is between a Picasso and a memoir and a Renoir. To them, it's just a picture, right? And a different kind of picture. But that makes a big difference when doing these investigations, to at least have some idea what you're talking about. So these criminal investigators are not authenticators. We have to go to experts, specific experts in those artists to be able to do that, to museum curators, to foundations that run the artwork for the specific artist, maybe to the catalogue raisonné, which is the catalogue of all the art that a specific artist may have created during his lifetime. At least that is known. There are pieces that aren't going to be in there, but that is what is known. So there's no authentication involved for art investigators, true crime investigators. It's done when we find a piece. And we want to make sure it's the one we're looking for.
It sort of calls to mind, I interviewed Ken Perenni, the author of Caveat Emptor, here on this podcast, who was a notorious and self-admitted art forger. And what struck me about his story and how it dovetails in with what you just mentioned was how he fooled the whole world. He had either a preternatural ability to truly mimic the greats, or simply he, you know, a stroke of luck that lasted decades. But it was a phenomenal getaway for him, because as you just articulated, there's a structure in place that represents that very specific, very well-trained amount of experts, and he fooled them all. Did he just slip through the cracks, or what's your analysis on that?
Well, you know, a good forger. going to be a pretty good artist in their own right. Okay. I've always looked at it from the standpoint of art. And, you know, a great artist creates art and new ideas. I mean, if you take a look at a person like Picasso, you know, he started in the beginning doing straight lines, regular paintings. And then throughout his whole life, he changed. Every couple of years, every 10 years, he did something new. He went through his blue period. He went through all different types of periods and different types of art. At one point, he said, you know, anything they can do, I can do better. So he decided to make new art. And, you know, people who are forgers, who basically copy, you know, students can go into the Louvre today and they can set up an easel and they can copy. You can't see it, but right behind me, my nephew gave me a painting of the Manet's Flutist. And it's his version of it. It's beautiful. It looks like a Manet. But it's a copy. I mean, he went to SCADS, the Savannah College of Art and Design, and learned how to paint, and he could do it. So, you know, I guess it is incredible that these individuals can create these artworks and sell them. But generally, they're going to be smaller pieces, not well-known in the art world itself, not major, you know, masterpieces. They're going to be things that they can slip by. And, you know, I defy any of them to do a $25 million Manet and have the whole world look at it and decide that it's real. It's not going to happen. You know, they're going to be things that go under the radar. Right. And so they stay under the radar in the private sales market, in collectors' houses. And basically they slip through. And that's how these pieces end up there. Now, again, there's pieces that have been bought that are in museums that are probably, you know, not by the artists themselves. That can happen. But they're not going to be the real high-end pieces. They're the more lower-end pieces that, you know, represent an art or an artist who's not as well-known and who the less money it's worth, the less many people look at it. Okay? So if a forger sticks to that scenario, they can get away with it, sure. Till they're caught, and then they can.
And let's talk about you for a second. You have had such an illustrious career within the FBI. You founded the Art Crimes Unit within the Bureau. Tell us about your passion for art and your calling in service as an agent. How did the two come together?
Well, when I started at the FBI in 1988, there was this great TV show. And the name of it was Miami Vice. Remember that. And there was Crockett and Tubbs, right? And Crockett was in Miami and he was chasing these drug dealers, driving these Lamborghinis on these cigarette boats, you know, wearing these nice suits. And I watched that. And I thought, you know, I'd like to do that. So when I first joined up, I thought I was going to go to Miami and be on a cigarette boat and be Sonny Crockett, you know. But I went through the FBI Academy and they sent me to Philadelphia. So it was a little different. Being on a cigarette boat in Miami, right?
More of a Rocky.
Exactly. I had to do the Rocky thing.
Yeah.
I was one of 5,000 policemen, you know, in Philly. So when I first got there, I was sent to interstate theft squad, which is basically a property crime squad, which goes into looking at people who are stealing loads on the highway, basically, and transported across state lines, like cigarettes, liquor, that type of thing. And my first case when I got to Philadelphia was a theft from the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. And it was a many hundreds of year old crystal ball. It's the second largest crystal ball in the world. It was collected by the Empress Zixi of China. And she was known as the Dowager Empress. And it was actually acquired by the museum in the 1920s. And this crystal ball had been stolen. It was valued at about $350,000. So as the new guy on the squad, you know, not chasing, you know, truckers, I got assigned to go investigate that ball. And as a result, we were able to recover that. Interesting story. It was found in the home of a young woman in Trenton, New Jersey, who was a witch. So, you know, a witch needs a crystal ball, right? So she had this crystal ball. It was given to her by, she was doing housekeeping. It was given to her by one of her clients who knew she was a witch. And it was just a gift. She, when we found it, it was in her bedroom. It was on a little stand and it had a baseball cap on it. I remember this is the Emperor Dowager Emperor Zixi of China's ball, right? And we find this thing and I said, well, why do you have a baseball cap on it? And she said, because it's a perfect crystal. When the sun hit it, it would diffract the sun rays and create fires. So she had to keep a ball cap on it to keep that from happening. It's a true story. So, you know, we were able to recover that. Once I did that, once we were involved in that, the Bureau said, well, you know, you're not bad at this. What they didn't realize was that I actually grew up in the antiques business. My mom and dad were antiques dealers. And my dad was a specialist in Asian antiques. So I kind of grew up around it. So I knew how to do a deal, you know, in the art world. And really, that's what it comes down to. When we talk about art investigation, art crime, it's not art history. It's not forensics. It's how to do a deal. And it's just like a drug deal. You want to do a deal in the art world and convince individuals undercover that you are the person you are.
We're going to take a quick break. More from our guest after this.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
I have to ask, and forgive me if this is such a basic question, but did the Bureau and was your task force aware that you had grown up with antiquities dealers as parents? Or was that literally unbeknownst to them as you got assigned to this first case? Because it's, to me, a remarkable preparation that you had in childhood to pave the way for this amazing career. What, did they know or not?
I wish I could say that they did, but it was just a coincidence.
Ah, that's a God wink. So, okay, it's about making the deal. So the thing is that your undercover work with the Bureau was so unique. You know, you'd appear to be an art appraiser at times, a dealer, an authenticator. So talk to us about creating these undercover identities. How did your persona change? How did it all go back to the art of the deal? What was all of that like?
Well, each case was separate. Each case was different, involving what I would be. In other words, if they needed an authenticator, I would do that. Let's say an agent from another state or something needed to help to identify artwork that was in a collection. And, you know, the guy was a drug dealer or something. I would go in and be the authenticator. I could look at it and say, okay, that looks like a Renoir. I can't say that it is one, but I could say it looks like it. Same style, same genre, same type of palette, same brush strokes. But is it really one? I don't know. But I could look at it and tell. If I needed an art dealer, that would be a different type of a role. You know, usually I would play a shady dealer. Mm-hmm. I go in, meet with the bad guy, supposedly, and you know, I would be the one who would be offering to sell his fake material. Like a Ken Peretti, I would be the guy who would say, hey, Ken, I've got clients that want to buy these pieces. We can do a deal. Of course, you know they're fake. And he would say, yes, and then we have him. You know, once we have that acknowledgement on tape, then he's done for. It all depended on the situation. If I was a buyer, I might be negotiating, say, for the Russian mob. And I'm using their money to buy this piece for them, but I have to make sure it's real and negotiate the price. So it all depended on what the case was that I would be involved in. But basically, I always played the same role myself. And that's because I had that background and upbringing in the business. So I could play any role in the business.
Wow. So how did the art crime team come to fruition? How did it and when did it begin?
Yeah, it was in 2005. So what had happened was, by then I had been in the Bureau since 1988, so it was 17 years. And I had recovered about $300 million worth of stolen art and cultural property in 20 different countries by then. And I was coming back from a case I had done in Copenhagen, Denmark, working with the Swedish National Police and the Danish police. And I got back and I thought, you know, the United States has no art crime team. We didn't have any kind of group that was trained to do these investigations. And I had worked with the Carabinieri. They have 300 investigators in Italy that do nothing but art crime investigations. They have, of course, that makes sense because, you know, in Italy, anything 6 inches in the ground is art. Civilization. Same thing that went with, like I said, the OCBC in Paris. They have 36 investigators, as well as investigators in London. But the U.S. had nothing. It had basically two guys. It was Bob in Philadelphia and Jimmy in New York. We were the FBI art crime team, right? The largest consumer country in the world. Wow. You know, 40% of all art in the world gets sold here in the United States. And yet, it's almost $80 billion, just to give you the number. And we had no team that was trained. So I went to headquarters, Washington, and I said, you know, we need to create a team just to keep up with the world and the value. And they agreed. And so we started with 8 FBI agents from around the country. It was a collateral duty. It wasn't, you know, a main job. It was something they would do along with their own investigations. And we started training. We trained them in Philadelphia because that's where I was. And we took them to different museums and whatnot and gave them different aspects of how to do, how to recognize art, cultural property. And we started working. By the time I had left, I think we had recovered about $150 million in 3 years worth of stolen art and cultural property through the team. And today, I think there's more than 20 individuals on the team. It's gone from 8 to 20, and they've recovered literally hundreds and hundreds of millions worth of stolen art and cultural property. So I'm proud to have said, be able to say I actually left a legacy at the FBI, which wasn't there before I started. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing. Yeah.
It's incredible. Did those other 7 have backgrounds in art, antiquities, anything like that? Or were they chosen based on their superior performance within the bureau of their main positions that were aside from that?
Now you give everybody too much credit if you think they had any background in art. Of course not. Basically, the requirement was 3 years experience in criminal investigations and a supervisor that said they could do it. What it was, and we were happy to get them. Believe me,
yeah,
it was funny. In the very beginning, I thought, well, you know what? Nobody wants to be on this team because everybody wants to, you know, catch drug dealers and break down doors and, you know, all that exciting stuff. Supposedly, nobody wants to look at art, right? And so we put out the word to the country, you know, all the agents, all the offices, and we got 75 applications. Believe it or not, I was expecting. I thought it'd be hard to find 10. We got 75 people who were qualified, who were interested. So we had to narrow it down to the 8. But I was pleasantly surprised in seeing all the interest on the team.
No, I don't. I mean, it's like we talked about before. I love it. That would be like my dream. But that's probably why I'm not part of the Bureau and I would probably mess it all up anyway. Stay with us. More of the Fox True Crime Podcast after this. Okay, so let's dive into the heist that occurred at the Swedish National Museum. Tell me what happened on December 22nd, 2000.
Well, on December 22nd, 2000, three individuals just went into the museum. It was late in the afternoon, after 5 o'clock. You got to remember now, this is Stockholm, Sweden, so it's dark, it's cold. Mm. People are out shopping in the middle of town. The museum's on the outskirts of town, right on the water. So these three individuals went into the front doors, and they had machine guns. And as they went in, they put everybody on the floor. They made everybody lay down. Two of these individuals then ran around the museum, and they were stealing 3 artworks, while the third person stood over guard with the guns. There was very few people in there. You know, you could imagine at that point in time, and that late in the day, not many people at all. So these two guys, they went around. They stole 2 by Renoir, 2 Renoir paintings, and a Rembrandt self-portrait. The total value of the heist that night was $42 million. It's the largest art crime in Swedish national history. Actually, it's probably the largest property crime in Swedish national history. So they had to make their getaway. And of course, as I said, the museum is right on the pier at the water in the harbor in Stockholm. So what they did was they set off 2 car bombs in the city. And what that did is stop the responders from getting to the museum. It took them 40 minutes for the police and fire department to get to the museum. At that point, then they also set down 2 tax strips on the main roads. So any cars that got by would lose their tires. And then they made their getaway. But how'd they do that? They couldn't go back into the city. They had parked a high-speed boat right at the pier at the museum. So they could run out to the boat. They jumped in, and all 3 of them made their getaway. So it was a pretty good heist. They had tax strips. They had car bombs to stop the police. They had machine guns, and they had a high-speed boat that they used as a getaway. So it looked pretty good. $42 million, three paintings, two by Renoir and the Rembrandt, and it looked like they're going to get away with this. But there was one problem. At one point, they pulled over, jumped off the boats, and ran up into the city up a number of steps. They didn't notice a fellow sitting over by the other side of the water. He was fishing. And he saw these guys jump out of their boats and run up into the harbor, and he thought that looked suspicious, but didn't think much more about it. The next day, of course, he reads about this huge heist in the Swedish newspapers, and he calls the police, this local police, and he says, you know, I saw these three guys jumping out of their boat last night, running up into the city. You know, it was kind of strange to me. So the police said, okay, well, where were they? And he tells them the location, says, and gives them the number off of the boat. Because he had written it down. Well, of course, the police go and they find the boat still sitting there at the pier. They run the numbers. They find out who was the owner. And they go investigate that. They go talk to the owner. And they find out. The owner says, yeah. He says, that was my boat, but I sold it about a month ago. So the police are very disappointed at that point. They're thinking, we missed out on a good lead here. And as they're walking out the door leaving, the owner of the boat says to them, hey, well, wait a minute. I got one thing. And they said, what? And he says, I have their credit card number. Yeah, I know. They bought the boat with a credit card.
Oh, my gosh. Right?
But look, if they were really all that smart, we'd never catch them. Okay? But there's always something that comes up. So, of course, they got the credit card number. They traced that back, and they were able to actually indict in Stockholm 10 people that they believe were involved in this heist. At that point, they also recovered one of the Renoirs worth about $4 million. They went to trial. 7 out of the 10 were convicted, but that left 3 out there that were acquitted at that point as not being involved. So they got 10-year sentences because of the gun and the theft, and that was the end of the story for the next 4 years. So remember, this happened in 2000. The trials were over in 2001. Then 4 years later, nothing else has happened. No other recoveries, no more word about the paintings. There's still a Renoir out there and the $35 million Rembrandt. So I start to team up, and I get a call from our agent in California, and his name's Chris. Chris calls me and says, Bob, have you ever heard of a Renoir that was stolen in a heist safe from a museum in Stockholm? And I said, yeah, there was a big heist about 5 years ago. It was a couple of Renoirs and a Rembrandt. So what's going on? He said, well, we've been doing this drug investigation here in L.A., and we've got this Bulgarian drug dealer named Boris. And Boris is already involved in a 2 key drug deal. So we've got him on a 10-year stint once we arrest him. I said, well, that's great. I said, well, what about it? And he said, well, he's been talking about selling the second Renoir. Remember, there was 2 stolen. We got 1 back. Now he's talking about selling the second one. Somehow he has custody of it. So I said to Chris, I said, look, that would be great. We have a brand new team. If we could recover that Renoir, it would be great for the team to get us started. He said, okay, I'll let you know what's going on. So he goes back. About 2 weeks later, I get a call, and he says, great news. We've recovered the second Renoir. It was called La Parisienne. He said, we took it to the Getty, and the curators at the Getty said it's the legitimate painting. So that was the good Renoir, worth $4 million also. So we got that back. So, of course, I said to Chris next, I said, what are you going to do next? He said, well, the special agent in charge wants to have a press conference on Monday. I said, well, before you do that, go back to Boris, your Bulgarian drug dealer who has the Renoir, and ask him about the Rembrandt. I mean, that's the big painting. It's worth $35 million. Does he know where that is? So he goes back, and he calls me back and says, yep, Boris knows. It's still in Stockholm, and Boris can introduce us to the individuals who have the Rembrandt. I said, okay, great. So at that point, we started an undercover called Operation Bullwinkle. And the reason we called it Bullwinkle is because we had Boris the Bulgarian. Of course, we didn't have Asha or Rocky the Squirrel or the Moose. We had Boris the Bulgarian. But now you know how the FBI names these operations, right? I thought the best one I ever heard was Operation Bullpen. And that was about a group of people who are selling fake sports memorabilia, you know, autographs.
Yeah.
Bull and pen, you know.
I love it. That's perfect.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. Anyway, so we had Operation Bullwinkle. And what that was an undercover operation to go to Sweden, meet with the criminals that still had the painting, and make a deal to try to buy the painting from them and do a buy bust. My operation on that was to be the undercover. So I was acting as an authenticator and professor for the Russian mob. And my deal was to buy the painting, make sure it's real, and do the deal. So we flew to Stockholm, Sweden. We met with the Swedish National Police. We met with the prosecutors. And basically they said that we could not do this there because Boris, our Bulgarian drug dealer, had an arrest warrant in Sweden. They wouldn't let him in the country to introduce me. So we did the next best thing. We created the operation in Copenhagen, Denmark. It's about a five-hour train ride from Stockholm. The reason we did that is because the FBI agents were geographically challenged. We could have gone right to Norway, which is right there, right across the border. But no, they had to go to Copenhagen and go 5 hours on a train to get there back and forth, So anyway, so we set the operation up in Copenhagen, where I flew to Copenhagen, got a room at the Scandic Hotel, and I started meetings with these individuals. Boris introduced me to these three individuals who were in custody of the painting. We negotiated for about 2.5 weeks after many, many months of conversations on the phone. And finally, they agreed to do this deal with me for $250,000 cash. Mm. But think about that. A $35 million painting, they're going to sell it to me for $250,000 in cash. So now everybody knows what that painting's worth, right? $250,000. But here's the thing. You have to remember, they had no money in it. There's no cost, no cost basis. So that $250,000 was all profit. And that's what they wanted. So I said, okay. So I had the $250,000 shipped over to me in $100 bills. We put it in a briefcase and waited for them. Finally, they agreed. I said, go home, get the painting, bring it back. So they left. They went back to Stockholm. Next morning, I get a call from the Swedish National Police. They say, everything's good. The painting's on the way. All three guys have gotten back on a train. There was a lot of movement last night between houses. And they're carrying a package. It looks like in a bag about the size of the painting. So they said to me, should we arrest them? I said, no. I said, wait, let them come. Let's let this happen, And they did. I give them a lot of credit. I mean, if the painting was stolen from the Met in New York City, I doubt that the NYPD would let it go to Canada. I don't think it would happen. But in this case, the Swedes let it come back down to Copenhagen. So all three guys get off the train, come walking back towards my hotel, about five blocks. One guy with the bag with the painting stays outside on the corner. The other two guys, they come up to my room, come back to where I was. They come in. I say to them, okay, what's going on? They say, well, we want to see the money. So at that point, I pull out a briefcase. I put $250,000 in cash on the bed. These guys sit on the bed. They count through every stack of $100 bills to make sure it's real, and they're happy. I say, okay, where's the painting? Go get the painting. Remember, I don't know the guys outside. I knew it, but I couldn't let it go. Let it on that I knew. They said, okay, we'll be back. So they leave. I'm sitting there waiting, maybe 7, 8, 10 minutes. I'm thinking, what's going on? I get a call. It's the Swedish police again. They say, something went wrong. I said, what happened? They said, well, all three of them ran away. I said, what do you mean they ran away? They said, they ran away. Do you want us to arrest them? I said, no. I said, if they get back on the train, stop them. But wait till they do that. Don't do anything until they get on the train. I hung up. I'm walking back and forth in this little room thinking, what could I have said wrong? I can't believe it. I want to hear the tapes. All this is being taped. I want to see what I said. Finally, I get another call. And it's against the Swedish police. They say, everything's okay. They had a fourth person come in the night before. That person actually had the painting. And he had a different room in a different hotel. So these three guys, when they came down with that bag, it was just a decoy. If we had stopped them at any point, we would have had nothing. They would have known we were the police. So it was a decoy to do a counter surveillance against us. So they went back. They go to the guy's hotel. They get the painting, and they're on their way back. Now, the fourth man's already been arrested. All three are coming back to my hotel. They come up into the room, the two guys again. This time they have the painting. We finally get it opened up. It's in this red velvet cloth. It took forever to open. And I'm looking at it, and it's real. It's the real painting. And the reason I knew was because there was four clips in the back of the frame that held the painting in. And these clips were at a certain angle because I had the photographs from the museum. And as a result, I could tell it had never been taken out of the frame. So I said to them, I said, hey, you guys never even took this painting out of the frame, did you? And they looked at me kind of aghast. And they said, of course not. It's a Rembrandt. I said, what are you guys? Are you guys art lovers? And they said, no. We're not art lovers. I said, excuse me. I didn't realize that, you guys were such art lovers. And they were. They just wanted the money. But they knew what they had. they had a Rembrandt, a real Rembrandt. It was done in 1630 when Rembrandt was 24 years old, and it was painted on copper, which at that time was a really, really expensive metal. You just didn't waste copper in 1630. It had gold flecks in the paint. And it was one of his first uses of chiaroscuro. Chiaroscuro is shadow in the portrait. So you can see on the side, there was a shadow on his face. It wasn't a full face from a portrait, which is what they used to do. This was a shadow with the chiaroscuro. And that's something that we use today all the time in portraiture, in photographs, everything. So they pulled the painting out. I could tell it was legitimate, so I gave the code word, which was, this is a done deal, and waited for about 20 seconds for the police to finally come in and do the SWAT team thing, and save me and save the painting and save everybody, right? Ultimately, they couldn't get in because the door key that they had didn't work. So I had to go open the door for him while I hid in the bathroom with the painting. When they all ran in, we were able to arrest everybody.
Oh my.
So we recovered. It was a $36 million painting all told. In the end, all the paintings were recovered. The thieves never got any money. Ultimately, those three guys that were involved in this situation with me, they were the ones that were acquitted. Remember, there was 10 people that were arrested in 2001? Well, seven were convicted. These three actually were involved, but they were acquitted at the time. And now they're going to be prosecuted for having the painting. And the most interesting part, I think, is that Boris, two things happened with Boris. First, he got a downward departure in Los Angeles. He went from 10 years in prison to probation for his cooperation in the case. And the second thing was that one of the three thieves that we were working with was Boris's son. So in this case, the father gave up his son. So there's no honor among thieves. And it was actually his son who had the Rembrandt. Ultimately, these guys were given two-year sentences in jail in Sweden. But the European Union courts, they annulled the sentence, saying that the use of the father against his son was a civil rights violation. Now, that wouldn't happen in the United States, but in Europe, that's what they looked at it. But I didn't care about that. What was important was getting that Rembrandt back. And the idea of the recovery of the painting there was the most important thing, as far as I was concerned. These guys, they did 6-8 months in prison, and then other things would happen to them. That's how it works. But I knew that we got our painting back. That case is a great case because it really shows the importance of cultural property protection. It shows how important a Rembrandt is, not just to the Swedish Museum, but to the Danes, to the United States. It's all of us. It's our culture and our history. And when we lose something like that, it affects everyone in the world, not just the owner, but all of us, because it belongs to all of us. Mm-hmm. And what else, what other piece of property could you imagine that three countries, Denmark, Sweden, the United States would get involved together to recover? They wouldn't do it for a Chevrolet, but they would do it for a Monet.
We'll be right back with more of this story. It really is a crime against the public. It's a crime against the culture that we all share. That's such a phenomenal story. And I have a few small questions. So you've answered what Boris got in exchange. You've answered that the three individuals I asked, I had written down, were they Bulgarian? Because one being his son, the answer is yes. So
he was actually Swedish.
Swedish.
And the two other individuals that were with him were Iranian.
Ah, so, and then regarding the Rembrandt, so was it in Stockholm the entire time? It never left Stockholm?
No, it was in a closet for 5 years.
Oh my goodness.
That's another shame. When somebody steals an artwork like that, they can't, basically, it's terrible because you can't do anything with it. I mean, basically, a painting, where are you going to sell it? Right. The criminals are thieves and they are businessmen, because they think they can get away with these things. They can. They do a good job of planning the robbery, but then they can't sell the materials. They're terrible businessmen. And, the real art in an art crime, it isn't the stealing, it's the selling.
How long did they say, or do you surmise, that it took to plan the heist? Because it sounded elaborate, right, with the tires, tax strips and the everything. How long did they say they had planned?
I'd say for a year.
A year.
They were planning that heist. Yeah, they had one person who was, basically he was in prison and he got out. And he met some of these other individuals in prison. And then as a result, they got together and were able to plan this out.
Right. Many people learn how to become criminals in prison, that's for sure. Your story is remarkable to me, too, because it illustrates the power of patience and the final component of the story that if you had authorized those guys to be arrested or captured or whatever, that it all would have fallen apart. But because of the patience to just wait, you were able to wait it out and then consummate the deal and result in the arrest. And most importantly, again, the getting back the Rembrandt. What did that feel like for you to be looking at this original self-portrait of a Rembrandt with the shadows and to be so close to it? What did it feel like when you saw the velvet wrap unfold and you saw that mastery up close?
Yeah. Interestingly enough, you say about the patients and all the cases, I had done this in maybe half a dozen to a dozen countries and by 2005. And in every case, it's all about patience. That's the greatest virtue of an investigator or an undercover agent. It's to set out the trap, set out the lead, you know, and put it out there and just wait and let the greed nibble, because that's what happens. The greed overcomes, you know, any kind of suspicion. And in the end, it's patience. Always sit back and be the patient one. It'll come to you. So that's what I've always found working undercover. As far as the feelings, I got to tell you, it's like it's a eureka feeling, you know, just for an hour, a couple of hours. It's like when, I don't know if you have any children, but I had three children and they're all born healthy and done well. And that feeling you get when your child is born and everything's okay and they're healthy and the mother's good, you just walk around on air for about a week. I mean, that's how I felt. And in these situations, when I recovered a piece, it would be for a couple of hours I'd walk around on air. Not as long as my kids, but, you know, for a couple of hours, it felt the same way. And then after that, it's a huge letdown. Okay, there's a crash that happens. It happened to me. I don't know about anybody else. But as an undercover agent, when you catch a tiger by the tail, like this, in a case, and it's tearing you all over the place, taking you everywhere, right? And you're following this tiger, and you're holding on for dear life, and you're patient, and it happens. When it's over, it's over. And it's a crash. It's just, boom, you're down again. And you got to start all over again on the next case. So for a little while, it's a crash. You know, it's like losing adrenaline. And the adrenaline goes away, and you have that crash. And then you have to restart. And so you do that. But it's a great feeling.
Oh, I can imagine. And that is why I could never be an undercover agent. I have no patience whatsoever. It's all over. Minute two. Emily just gets out of the car. I can't do this. Talk to us about, you've done so many of these cases, notwithstanding this one, perhaps this is the answer, but what was the most audacious method of theft that you encountered as an agent? Because I pictured, like, when you talked about the crystal ball, I was like, how does someone get a ball? You know, picturing, like, someone pretending to be pregnant. Like, she wasn't pregnant when she walked in the museum, and now she's pregnant walking out. The ball's, you know, it's sort of ridiculous, but I can't. The creativity, I can only imagine. Was there something that was ridiculously audacious that you recall from your career?
Well, when you say audacious, I mean, there's two ways of thinking of that. One would be somebody that has the chutzpah, just walk in and take it.
True.
You know, like a shoplifting.
True.
And I've seen that happen. Or the other way of thinking about it is who really planned something out and did a good job of doing it. I had another case in the Museum of Fine Arts in Nice, France. Mm-hmm. And in that case, a group of individuals got together and they stole two Bruegel paintings, and a Monet and a Sicily. And the total value was maybe about $8 to $12 million for the four paintings. And what they did was they dressed as street workers in Nice, and they drove a van and a couple of motorcycles. So they went up to the Museum of Fine Arts. They had cased it to see when the fewest people were there, and they knew that on Saturdays was English Day until noon, and that meant that people who spoke English could go and get in for free, and there were English curators. So very few people were there because it was France, you know? So they went on a Saturday dressed as street workers, people who worked for the city, and they had these gray coveralls on. They went in, they had guns, and they stole the four paintings. All were fairly close to the entrance, so they had cased it to know where these paintings were. And they made their getaway in the van outside and on the motorcycles, which I thought was pretty good pretty good heist. It was well thought out, and they made their getaway. Ultimately, we caught them in an undercover operation in Marseille, France, where I worked on that out of Miami and Marseille and Barcelona. And, you know, it was terrible work, but somebody has to do it.
I know. Never happens in, you know, Alabama and somewhere random. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if it happens in Alabama, I'm probably not going to be there.
Right. So, you know, art is, it's so much more than just a gorgeous painting or a historically significant sculpture. It represents so much more. What does it mean to you to have been able to protect and recover such priceless pieces of culture and history? We talked about your legacy in the Bureau, but for the concept of the art itself.
It's great. It's great that these paintings could come back. One of the most important pieces was a original copy of the U.S. Bill of Rights. And stolen during the Civil War in 1865 by a trooper who was with Sherman's troops coming back from Atlanta. And they were passing through North Carolina, and they went to the State House, and they basically ransacked documents out of the State House of North Carolina. And one of these troopers from Indiana, Union troopers, stole the North Carolina copy of the Bill of Rights that was sent to the state in 1789 by George Washington to be ratified. So that was gone from 1865 to about 2003. And in that case, I was undercover again as a philanthropist who was going to buy it for the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. And what was interesting, I was dealing with attorneys and acting as the person who was going to put the $4 million up. Actually, the thing was worth $100 million. If you could sell it, it was valued at $100 million. But they wanted to sell it for $4 million. They had bought it for, I think, $100,000 from some sisters, a pair of sisters who lived in Indiana, who still had it in the family way back from 1865. That trooper sold it for $5 to this family. And this family had kept it in their house all that time. So anyway, we did this, this undercover investigation. I acted as a philanthropist, and we were able to recover that piece. And I guess it's probably one of the most prideful pieces that I got back because, you know, as an FBI agent, I'm sworn to uphold the Constitution. And I never actually thought I'd actually hold the Constitution. Yeah, the original handwritten copy, you know, one of 13. It's because there were 13 states, you know, and one of 13 that was supposedly ratified as the Bill of Rights. So, I mean, it was really interesting to be involved in that. It was huge. It was 5 feet high. It was on Calgut, you know, it's how they would make the pieces. They would write it with black gall ink. It was signed by John Adams. It was amazing, you know, to be able to have that. So I was very proud, happy, you know, I'm proud to be able to be part of that recovery since, I swore an oath to uphold the Constitution. And here we recovered it.
I have chills. And that was the first thing I thought of when you said it was missing from 1865 to 2003. I thought, that's generational holding. So there are families that know where it is, that pass it down. And I can't imagine either knowing that deep, dark secret within a family or not knowing, as we've talked about, the gem in the basement or the gem in the attic, or you have no idea, you've never opened that box from your great, great, great grandmother or the like. It's just mind-blowing to think such a priceless, regardless of appraisal, such a priceless part of our American history was originally sold for $5 and then, you know, was hanging out in an attic or wherever for over 100 years. 125. Hover, thank you. Math is also not my strong point.
Yeah, but that's a lot of times that happens. Families inherit things and they don't realize them. And that's happened on a number of occasions as well.
Who is your favorite artist?
That's a great question. I like parts of all of them. You know, I like Jackson Pollock's strips paintings. Yeah. I like some of Mark Rothko's, you know, the double paint paintings. I think my favorite painting, it hangs in the Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia, and it's called The Muscle Gatherers. It's by Renoir, and it's a life-size painting of a woman, I guess, Renoir's housekeeper with his children, and they're on the cliffs. Near Dieppe in France, and they're gathering mussels, and the sky and the scene of the sea behind them, it's just magnificent. And if you can Google it up, or if your listeners can Google it up, take a look at it. It's just a beautiful painting.
It is beautiful. I just pulled it up while you're saying that.
There you go.
That is beautiful. Oh.
And then if you see it in real life, it's just amazing. The Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia, it's not a well-known institution, but it's one of the finest in the world. There's more Cezannes there than there are in any institution in France.
Oh,
they
wow.
have almost as many Renoirs. Dr. Barnes was buying all these pieces in the early 1900s, and it was before Renoir and Cezanne, all of them were as famous as they are, and he was one of the top 10 richest men in the world. So he literally was getting shiploads of these paintings. And today, that collection is magnificent.
Oh, I can imagine. Those are always my favorite museums. I agree. The smaller ones. All right. So let's end with your memoir, Priceless. Tell us about where people can find it. I cannot wait to read it. And tell us a little bit about what listeners can expect to find within those pages.
Well, Priceless is a memoir that I wrote in 2010. It's been around a while. It was a New York Times bestseller. It's been out for a while. It can be bought on Amazon or even Barnes & Noble. You can order it, get it to the library. All the libraries carry it. It's in 12 languages at this point. It's been written in 12 languages around the world. And it's a memoir of my career. I talk about from the beginning in 1988 all the way through to 2008 in cases that I did, maybe 15 different undercover cases that we worked on, including artifacts from Peru, golden artifacts from Peru, paintings from Sweden, again, paintings from Nice, France. So we talk about the Bill of Rights case, fraud case involving the Art Antiques Roadshow and some of the people who do their, quote, appraisals. All kinds of cases and different things that are interesting in throughout my career. And I think that anyone who gets it, most people like it because I didn't write it for the art community. I wrote it for the general public to get a little bit of an appreciation of what art cultural property is, and also to enjoy it, to have fun. So it's written in a first-person active role, and I think that anyone who picks it up might enjoy it.
I think they will definitely enjoy it. I know I will, and I know my family will too.
Oh, it's being set up right now at Amazon for a series. So we'll see how that
great.
Goes. Scripted.
That's amazing. I'll look forward to watching that too then. And then I also just have to say that a part of what you've helped recover includes Geronimo's Eagle Feather War Bonnet, which seemed particularly beautiful to me too, and really incredible that you recovered that. So that's in the book too, right?
Sure, yeah. That's part of another case involving a group of artifacts that I was involved in recovering in Santa Fe, New Mexico. It was American Indian material that was being stolen out of the ceremonial kivas of the Indians there. And so what was happening was they had traders going in, basically stealing these pieces out of the ceremonial, they call them kivas, which are like their chapels. And these are like different lodges of individuals. It's a long story, but they were taking them and selling them to dealers in Santa Fe who would then turn around and sell them to the art market. And they might steal one for $50 and then it would sell for $5,000. So that's how these pieces were being, being taken out and stolen and sold. So I did a 6-month undercover operation in Santa Fe. We talk about that in the book.
Wow. Bob Whitman, thank you so much. It's been such an honor to have you here with us today to get a taste of your really incredible legacy. Thank you for your service. You're just phenomenal, and I cannot wait to read your book. Thank you. Do you have any final words you'd like to share with listeners before we conclude?
Sure. Hey, I want everybody to know, go to a museum, have fun, enjoy seeing what you're looking at, but don't take anything.
Definitely don't take anything. Please rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app. If you have a story or topic you want to hear on the show, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email at truecrimepodcast@fox.com.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.